sustaining professionalism in healthcare delivery, and the contribution of faith. There's a book by Jonathan Glover, who is the head of medical ethics and law at King's College London, called Humanity, A Moral History of the 20th Century, and it was published in 2001. I had actually, many years ago, when he was at Oxford, tried to get Jonathan to come and give a lecture at Guy's, where I was worked, on causing death and saving lives. And he never answered my letters, but he then turned up at King's, where I was the dean, and so I could get him to give a lecture. And I was talking to Jonathan about this amazing book. I mean, it's about this thick, 1,000 pages. I said, how do you write a book like that, Jonathan? He said, Cyril, he said, you write a book like that by taking 10 years and never answering phone calls from people like you. Well, I recommend the book to you. And he writes, at the start of the 20th century, most people accepted the authority of morality. At the end of the century, it was hard to be confident either about moral law or about moral progress. Concepts such as professionalism depend on a sense of moral values, a sense of duty. Adam Smith, as you know, is now on the back of the £20 note. And most people are aware of his seminal contribution, The Wealth of Nations. Few people realise that Adam Smith wrote another book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and it's of equal importance, because he pointed out in this book that a sense of duty was the main way in which transactions or markets were regulated. I heard very much the same notion on the Today programme this morning. And I've argued in the past that the conscience of the doctor is of equal importance, and perhaps more important, to the patient than the contractual relationship the doctor has agreed with his or her employer or with the National Health Service. What then is this basis of moral values that we appear to have lost? Some years ago, I heard the chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, give a lecture on the civil society and its enemies. The connection to Karl Popper and the open society and its enemies was, of course, intentional. In his lecture, Dr. Sacks argued that the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament as we know it, was perhaps a good foundation for the development of moral laws, and the state should try to enshrine these values in its constitution or laws, so that the tyranny of the majority, or maybe even the tyranny nowadays of focus groups, could be avoided. I have a bit particular thing about focus groups. When I was dean of the medical school, we were accused that we were discriminating against black and minority ethnic groups in the admission policy to the medical school. It wasn't true, and it was a mistake of statistics. But I went to see Herman Ouseley, who was chairman of the Council for Racial Equality at the time, talked to him about it, and he supported our view. So I then phoned the Department of Health and asked what the government's view would be. And I got a phone call back, and they said the government's view of the matter would entirely depend on how the newspapers dealt with it or what their focus groups told them. A sense of moral values could be introduced there as well, I think. For doctors, I won't tell you which government, by the way. For doctors, the Hippocratic Oath, or in its various developments over the centuries, in the various codes of practice, have been taken as the foundation, and it describes the relationship between the patient and the doctor. The model equivalent is set out by the General Medical Council in the Duties of a Doctor and expanded in their guidance on good medical practice. There are links to all these documents in the script, which you can get at the end of the lecture. Good medical practice has gained wide acceptance around the world, and at our medical school it was affirmed in public by all graduates on qualification. But there are still concerns. In a postmodern world where moral values are questioned or non-existent, there are anxieties that the professionalism of doctors cannot be taken for granted, a question earlier this afternoon along the same lines. A recent working party from the Royal College of Physicians of London, chaired by Baroness Julia Cumberledge, who either you or I have to thank for me being here today, if you see what I mean, stated in the foreword that social and political factors, together with the achievement and promise of medical science, have reshaped attitudes and expectation, both of the public and of doctors. This report sought, and I believe succeeded, in redefining medical professionalism for our time. And in a series of roadshows, the Royal College and the King's Fund, where I now work, have striven to take this message to doctors throughout the country, particularly to young doctors and to medical students. The Royal College defined, in the Cumberledge report, medical professionalism in clear terms. Medicine, it wrote, is a vocation in which a doctor's knowledge and clinical skills and judgment are put in the service of protecting and restoring human well-being. This purpose is realised through a partnership between the patient and doctor, one based on mutual respect, on individual responsibility, and the appropriate accountability. There was a Victorian aphorism in a book of advice to travellers that said that a good doctor was better than a bad doctor and almost as good as no doctor at all. That this is no longer true is because of the amazing advances in biomedical science, starting in the Enlightenment with the acceptance of empirical science and continuing over the centuries, but most particularly in the last 50 years or so. The scientific method has led to extraordinary advances in medicine. I've been qualified now for 45 years, and I am amazed. Imagine a world where people with peptic ulcers had their stomachs removed, where children always died of leukemia, where arthritis of the hip led to confinement to a wheelchair and an early death from pneumonia, where thousands of children died each year of poliomyelitis, and I could go on. Many people, and probably I'm not the only person in this room to whom this applies, would not be living now with the standard of medicine of 45 years ago. And indeed, one of the problems of the National Health Service is that so many people are living with diseases from which they would have died. Whilst we may have questions sometimes about what constitutes good evidence, we'd be foolish not to require adequate scientifically acquired evidence for medical interventions. I sometimes think we ought to be even more concerned about the scientific interventions for not doing, the evidence for not doing things. In Bertolt Brecht's play Galileo, there's a wonderful line where he says the chief poverty of science is imaginary wealth. And the aim of science is not to achieve infinite wisdom, it's to avoid infinite error. But is science enough? There's an essay by Robertson Davies, the Canadian author, in which he discusses, can the doctor be a humanist? Can the doctor be a humanist? And he argues that the twin snakes that entwine the caduceus or medical staff of Aesculapius represent science and wisdom, and that you need the two, science and wisdom, in contention and seeking the balance between them at all times. The practice of medicine requires science and wisdom, or empathy and humanity. Does this empathy and humanity and the application of professionalism affect the outcomes? Well, the evidence is that it does. There was a review in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2005 where Dr. Larson wrote, "The published literature suggests that physicians who display a warm, friendly, and reassuring manner with their patients are more effective. Empathy makes patients more forthcoming about their symptoms and concerns, facilitating medical information gathering, which in turn leads to more accurate diagnosis and to better care. And we know that patients are more satisfied with physicians who behave professionally. As I was coming down here today, I was reading this week's JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, and there's an article entitled Physicians Behaving Badly. And what it points out is that failure to communicate between doctors and specialists looking after patients leads to worse outcomes for patients, both in terms of morbidity, mortality, and in cost. Professionalism really matters. Patients are more likely to cooperate with treatment if they trust their doctors. And interestingly, they make fewer complaints, and if that doesn't convince, they're less likely to sue. Put simply, doctors have to like people and to care about them as well as for them. Elizabeth Allen some years ago wrote that being good at science at school was not a good enough reason to become a doctor. You need a sense of vocation. A friend of mine is the postgraduate dean for London, Elizabeth Pace. And some years ago, she was talking to a group of sixth formers about being a doctor, sort of talk that many doctors give and certainly many deans give. And when she'd finished, a girl came up to her and said, "Miss Pace, I would love to be a doctor, but I can't stand the sight of blood." And Elizabeth said, "Don't worry," she said, "we can help you with that. It's when you can't stand the sight of people that we have a problem." Doctors have to care about people as well as for them.